The Cars' first album was the best thing I ever borrowed from my friend Mel's older sister, Melissa. At first, I only liked the biggest hit, Just When I Need It, with its catchy, lurching beginning, its edgy synthesizer lines, and the irresistibly cool, emotionally detached line that starts the song.
I don't mind you coming here, wasting all my time, 'cause when you're standing oh so near, I kinda lose my mind. It's not the perfume that you wear, it's not the ribbons in your hair.
I also especially like the way the drummer switches accents during the last verse. He hits the snare on the second and fourth beats during the first and third line of the verse, and then does a quick and jarring but glorious switch to the first and third beats for the second and fourth line.
I don't mind you coming here and wasting all my time, 'cause when you're standing out so near, I kinda lose my mind.
I used to air drum this song all the time in high school, and my friend Alan would tease me relentlessly about how simple the drums were. He was a Rush fan himself and spent many hours learning to air drum the incredibly arcane and egregiously overblown drumming of Neil Peart. I argued that the subtle, quirky, less-is-more approach of the Cars' David Robinson was far funkier and cooler, but he just laughed at me. After all, he was a child of the 70s, musically speaking, and the 70s were all about bigger and fatter. Longer guitar solos, bigger drum kits, lower slung basses, more hair, wider pant legs, and so on. My decade had yet to blossom. The music that really spoke to me was still a few years away from coming into its own, and the true principles of dry production, minimalist funk were far off down the road. I like to feel that I've been vindicated over the years, but I'm sure Alan would still laugh at me. Anyway, I loved Just What I Needed, and I hated the rest of the album. It was so angular and quirky, and it wasn't at all what rock was supposed to be about. Then I started liking Good Times Roll.
Let them leave you up in the air. Let them brush you rock and roll. And let the good times roll. Let the good times roll. Let the good times roll.
Then the wonder of side two suddenly became clear, and I fell in love with the album.
Oh,
In retrospect, it seems that the album heralded the coming of New Wave, or, in Portuguese, Bossa Nova, and opened up people's ears to some of the radically different sounds and structures that popular music could take. The Cars were also able to bridge two previously hostile camps, the New Wavers and the Rockers, and showed both sides that they needn't be enemies. It's so easy to blow up your problems. It's so easy to play up your breakdown. It's so easy to fly through a window. It's so easy to move with the sound. They were voracious sonic experimenters, and the fact that they had three guitarists, two of whom swapped lead vocal duties, as well as a drummer and a keyboard player, meant that they could each go pretty far out on textural tangents while still retaining a cohesive structure to a song. Another group that, years later, would also use their abundance of guitarists to their sonic advantage, jacking relatively simple song structures into outer space with their wild interlocked textures, is Radiohead. Although you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody else who would willingly lump these two bands together. Of course, I also think Junior Brown and Jimi Hendrix are opposite sides of the same coin. Part of the magic of their sound was that they hooked up with an extremely meticulous producer who brought out their best, Roy Thomas Baker, perhaps best known for the operatic scale of his work with Queen. Obsessive to a fault, Baker would work and rework a track to within an inch of its life, but all that work would prove itself in the final mix. There's a story that the Cars, or as my mom likes to call them, the Car Doors, went to London to record an album, and one day Benjamin Orr, the bassist, went by himself to the studio to lay down some tracks. He returned late that night, after some 12 hours of work, and the band asked him how the recording went. He said they didn't actually do any recording. "What the hell did you do?" they wanted to know. "Well," he replied, "we started to get a good bass sound."
I don't care.
The other really cool thing about the first Cars album is that the first three songs on it are each exactly 3 minutes and 44 seconds. I always wondered if they did that on purpose, if they even could do that on purpose. In spite of all their strengths, it must be said that the Cars have some of the worst lyrics ever sung. I'm a Flick Fandango phony? Fortunately, the vocal quality matches very well with the material, so I tend to just ignore the meaning of the lyrics, if indeed there is any, and just sing along. Like some other groups, the Cars started off strong and got progressively worse with each album until they were virtually unlistenable to. Once they replaced the drummer with a machine and they smoothed out their sound, it was a downhill ride. There were occasional moments in their later albums. I really like Drive from Heartbeat City, but for the most part, I lost interest in them after Panorama, their third album. Who's gonna tell you when it's too late? Who's gonna tell you things aren't so great? You can't go on thinking nothing. Sure, it was great that super dork Rick Ocasek managed to get it on with supermodel Paulina Poroskova, thereby instilling hope in dorks the world around. But by that point, his music had lost a lot of its vitality. Somebody once asked one of the members of Duran Duran why rock stars married supermodels, and he replied, licking his balls, because they can. Some things that I say to her, they just don't seem to buy. But that first Cars album stands out as one of the 10 best rock albums of all time. Depending on how charitable I'm feeling towards I'm in Touch with Your World, I would even classify The Cars as a perfect album. It's all mixed up. Having said that, I must point out that my favorite Cars song, It's All I Can Do, isn't on their first album, it's on the second, Candy O. It's a perfect example of the kind of intricate layering they were capable of. Once you start listening to the individual guitar lines that make up the bulk of the song, the bewildering complexity of the interlocking parts reveals itself. It doesn't sound like a complicated, quirky song, but scratch a little beneath the surface, and it's easy to get lost. It's all I can do to keep waiting for you. It's all I can do. It's all I can do. One too many times. Like listening to a Bach fugue, you can either hear the overall structure of the song, or you can listen to one of the many parts, but you can't do both at the same time. The whole thing is propelled by David Robinson's lurching, angular drumming, although, again, it sounds perfectly natural until you really start listening to where the accents are falling. And the keyboard part just kills me, especially in that last verse, where it starts low and then slowly creeps up in a beautiful, heartbreaking arc. But I must confess, there's something else at work here. Something that doesn't really have anything to do with the song. Something that makes every listening of this track, and there have been hundreds, a bittersweet experience. Her name is Jennifer. Jennifer was a blonde actress from Texas, take this as you will, who went to Interlaken and who was far too beautiful for her own good. Or anybody else's, for that matter. Shortly after I got involved with my first girlfriend, Tina, in my senior year, Jennifer took an aggressive fancy to me. She showered me with compliments, wrote me love letters, and generally made herself irresistible to me by making me feel irresistible to her. Although I adored and craved Jennifer's attention, I stayed true to Tina. As the school year wound down and graduation approached, along with the inevitable end of relationships that accompanied a boarding school graduation, Tina and I started having trouble. One night, during the last week of school, Jennifer and I went for a walk down by the lake. Down by the lake where some of the most significant events of my early life occurred. Down by my lake. It was a beautiful night. She was a beautiful girl. My resolve left me, and we ended up kissing. Flooded with guilt, I immediately confessed everything to Tina, and she forgave me, but the cracks had formed, and, later in the summer, Tina and I drifted apart for good. Meanwhile, I carried a torch for Jennifer. We wrote each other aching letters of desire. We made each other youthful promises. Over the years, we had a couple of frightening, exhilarating moments together. A Thanksgiving weekend back at high school in the unfortunate company of a math teacher. A one-night visit to my college dorm. Her graduation a year after mine. I burned for her for a couple of years, and then, when I finally got to actually spend some time with her in New York City, alone at last, far away from school and parents and any other distractions, she plunged my torch into an ocean of ice. She was the one I couldn't have, the one who wanted the chase but was uninterested in the catch, or, as the Cars sing, I once played the song so many times in a row that my next-door neighbor came over and begged me to stop. Embarrassed that my heartbreak was on such public display, I turned it off, pulled the record from the turntable, and filed it away for years. It wasn't until I bought Just What I Needed, the Cars 2-CD Best Of collection, that I allowed myself to listen to that song again. And even though it's been almost 20 years since that spring by the lake, the song still brings back a flood of bittersweet emotion every time I hear it. It's All I Can Do.